Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, October 17th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, your link to media criticism from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab, alongside regular panelists and J-School colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On this week's program, debate number two. Did President Obama win on points? Did he staunch the bleeding from the first debate? Did Romney hold his own? Well, opinions differed, of course, but almost all media outlets thought that last night's big moment came near the end when the moderator fact-checked the candidates in real time. How important is the controversy over Libya to the voters? Have the news media given it full, fair, and nuanced coverage? And why did the New York Times refuse to put a congressional hearing about it on page one? The journalist who joked that Romney and the Republicans didn't care about black people drowning is back on the job in Washington. And Felix Baumgartner's jump from the edge of space, quote-unquote, becomes both a news and marketing sensation. Well, let's start with last night's contest between the president and Mitt Romney. It was clearly a much more combative affair, despite pre-debate predictions that the candidates would have to be careful and respectful when taking questions from undecided voters. The media largely portrayed it as a boxing match, and most, even the folks over at Fox News, marked their scorecards as a victory on points for Barack Obama. Instant polls by CBS and CNN both showed debate watchers giving him a slight edge. The president definitely threw big punches on everything from women's health to Romney's pension plan. And while the Republican nominee did take it to Obama again on a sputtering economy, reporters and pundits alike thought Romney missed an opportunity when the president claimed he labeled the deadly attack on our consulate in Benghazi an act of terror the day after the tragedy.
It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct about that.
The administration indicated that this was a reaction to a video and was a spontaneous reaction. It took them a long time to say this was a terrorist act by a terrorist group.
Well, as you could hear, moderator Candy Crowley of CNN tried some real-time fact-checking of the candidates. The instant reaction on Twitter and later from the spin room was jubilation from Democrats and outrage from Republicans. When asked about it a bit later by colleague Anderson Cooper, Crowley defended her comments, though she acknowledged Romney's main point of contention was accurate.
It was one of those moments, and I could even feel that here. When you say something, you're not expecting. It's just that was the natural thing to come out of me going, actually, he did, call it an act of terror. When half the crowd claps for that and the other half claps for, but they kept telling us this was caused by a tape. So, in the main, the thrust of what Governor Romney was saying, which is why I went back and said that. But I just think he picked the wrong kind of way to go about talking about it.
Well, before we get specifically, Lee, into Candy Crowley's, insertion of herself into that and how well she did a job of fact-checking it, would you agree that the Libya discussion was sort of the big moment of that debate?
There were a couple of big moments of the debate. I think the Libya discussion was one of them. My own favorite moment of the debate was when President Obama channeled Harry Truman. I was sitting at home in my chair going, you got to say, the buck stops here. You're the commander in chief. You can't lay it off on Hillary Clinton or anybody else. And he stepped up and did that. I thought that was both necessary, but also presidential. And were Mitt Romney to become president, I would expect no less of him.
Let's come back to Hillary Clinton and all of that in just a minute. But Charles, it did seem to me that the media at least focused much of their attention last night and this morning on whether or not Candy Crowley was right to jump in, whether she in fact called out Mitt Romney on making a misstatement about the president's Rose Garden address, and whether or not she also gave Romney some cover later when she said, essentially, in words that were maybe not as clear, that Romney's primary contention about the weeks that it took for the White House to get out an accurate statement was also true.
It's kind of a fascinating relic of the era in which we live, that a journalist would be both hailed and criticized simultaneously for calling out a mistruth. I don't know where we've reached this point in which lying is to be tolerated and false equivalency is to be embraced. Or we're supposed, I mean, I think our job is to call it when we see it. And when you see something that is factually untrue, I'm not saying a lie, I'm saying an error. That was just an error of fact that she was pointing out. And the response to it, both, I think on either side of the, I mean, one side is saying that Candy Crowley deserves a Pulitzer Prize for calling out an error. The other side is saying she needs to be thrown under the bus for calling out an error. I think they're equally ridiculous.
I guess I wonder, though, Lee, if the dangers and maybe the value of this sort of real-time fact-checking that she was doing on live TV, because it's pretty hard when both candidates are talking over her for her to get into much nuance. I mean, what the president said in the Rose Garden, and we'll quote it exactly in a moment, could be read one way or the other. What Romney said about the cover-up, if you like, could also be interpreted in more ways than one. So how hard is it for her to try to insert herself in there and be a fact-checker with just a few seconds to do it?
I agree with Charles. It's hard, but it was necessary. And by doing it, she overran, it, according to what she said. Those were rules of the debate commission, the way that that debate had been set up, that she consciously chose to violate. And I applaud her. I don't know if she deserves a Pulitzer for that, but I applaud her as much for that sort of good, critical, and I would argue ethical thinking about, I'm not there as eye candy, okay? I'm there to be a journalist. I'm there to do a job. And that's what she was trying to do.
Let's talk about that a bit more, Charles, because as we know, both of the campaigns, Romney and Obama campaigns, agreed to a contract basically saying the moderator shall not ask follow-up questions. The moderator will be the traffic cop, and that's basically it. Somehow, Candy Crowley didn't get the memo, and she decided to call them out on it before the debate. I'm going to ask follow-up questions. She asked a couple, perhaps not as many as she would have liked, given the town hall format.
Yeah, and good for her. Again, I mean, I don't think journalists should ever subsume themselves to the role of traffic cop? I guess you described it as that's not what we're there for. And again, I got to stress the fact that she didn't say, "You lying liar." She merely pointed out a literal factual error. Now, unfortunately, it was a terrible factual error on Governor Romney's part, which really took what I'm sure he thought was going to be a right uppercut and turned it into a sort of roundhouse to the side of his head. But regardless, to me, it was equivalent to saying, you know, the president's tie is blue, and her going, actually, it's red. We all see it's red, because she's holding a transcript in her hands saying, he did say that.
Well, okay, so everyone did else parsed it, Lee, so let's parse it too. Here is exactly what President Obama said on September 12th in the Rose Garden, according to the transcript. "No acts of terror will ever shake the resolve of this great nation, alter that character, or eclipse the light of the values that we stand for. Today, we mourn four more Americans who represent the very best of the United States of America. We will not waver in our commitment to see that justice is done for this terrible act. And make no mistake, justice will be done." Okay, now you could say that he called it an act of terror. You could say that that was a generic statement that was preceded by comments about 9/11 and a lot of other things. Was it open to interpretation, or did he say it was an act of terror right after the event, while his White House later took 2 weeks to get to that same conclusion?
I think it's deliberately ambiguous. I actually applaud the deliberate ambiguity. at that moment, President Obama was not just speaking to the American people. He was speaking to people all over the world, but particularly people in the Middle East. Folks have got to get over this notion that when the president steps into the Rose Garden, the only people in the listening, viewing audience happen to be Americans who are tuned to their radios, televisions, or reading their newspapers. And so I think that the statement was on purpose ambiguous. It's the kind of ambiguity that you would hope when you're still trying to get facts, when you don't know what's happened exactly. You don't even know an accurate body count for all I know at that point. So, of course it's open to interpretation, as it should be.
I wonder, Charles, clearly it seemed that at the very best case for Romney, he lost an opportunity to try to make the broader argument. But I wonder if the media aren't going to play him some favors over the next week, because the final debate is about foreign policy. So doesn't this whole dust-up give us, the journalists, an opportunity to keep pounding away at the Libya cover-up, or whatever phrase you want to use, from now till then?
It does. And I think it also gives them an opportunity to look at even the broader context. There were security cuts in the State Department in two consecutive budgets that were forced in by House Republicans over the opposition of a lot of Democrats and the president. So it's a risky strategy for Governor Romney to go too deep down that path. I also think that to some level, the broader argument of the Libya dust-up just isn't that broad of an argument. It's a very narrow foreign policy dispute about something that took place, and it's just full of the risk of politicizing a tragedy, and that's always risky.
Let me come back to that. There are several different angles that I want to approach the Libya story from before we leave it. But before we get off the debate, you know, both candidates, I thought, also avoided direct answers, as we might have expected, to questions about other things, about gun control, about gas prices. Did we really think that the candidates were going to have to be more direct in their responses because the questions were coming from citizens?
Well, there's hope and expect. So I can hope one thing and expect another. But that was actually what I thought Candy Crowley was trying to do, was a person would ask what I thought was a really straightforward question. How do you feel about the assault weapons ban? How do you feel about the fact about women get paid 72 cents on the dollar that men make? And both candidates would zing off into whatever talking points they kind of brought into the room with them. And then she would try to steer them back and say, no, you got asked this question. So let's take a chance on answering this question. And again, journalistically, I think that's what she's supposed to do. Her expertise is in getting people to answer questions after they blow off the question the first three times. That's what she's good at, and that's what she was trying to do.
I kind of wish, frankly, that the other little rule that we didn't learn about until the last minute, the fact that the campaigns agreed the microphones would go off the second that the person finished asking their question. I wish there had been an opportunity to see if there had been any follow-ups from the audience. Sometimes their follow-ups could be a lot more intriguing and troublesome for the candidates than the ones from the journalists. Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton a little while ago, Lee, and Charles, I'm going to ask you the first little bit about that. She came out yesterday, or at least was quoted yesterday by CNN and others, before the debate, saying that she took responsibility for the attack on the consulate. And some people saw that in the media as giving the president cover just before the debate, but just as many others were claiming that, with the same amount of certainty, that she was trying to separate herself from the White House and their misleading statements. But either way, it seems that the president kind of short-circuited the whole thing by what he said in the debate last night.
Yes, and that was an important moment, as Lee alluded to earlier. I think that by claiming responsibility for it and owning that issue, he's actually providing probably very necessary cover to his Secretary of State to go out and do the very hard work of diplomacy on the ground in a region that is moving under our feet every day. And I think the foreign policy debate next week will be a really interesting contrast, I think. And I hope that this week's journalism starts to sort of pull this apart a little bit between the kind of, you know, Clint Eastwood as Secretary of State, all problems can be solved by bluster and bravado, versus the really hard work of diplomacy on the ground. And I think that contrast is something that journalists could do a fine job of talking about.
You have to wonder, Lee, before we talk a little bit more about journalists' responsibilities, clearly the media communications strategy was coordinated in some way between the State Department and the White House before the Secretary of State goes out and takes responsibility. Was there some calculation during the day that that wasn't playing well so that the president felt he needed to be more statesmanlike about it?
Okay, so I got up this morning with a bad cold and a rose-colored pair of glasses. I think there's a third interpretation here that at least makes as much sense to me. Hillary Clinton should take responsibility. It is, to coin a phrase, in her wheelhouse. There's responsibility that goes all the way up the chain of command. We're so used to people denying responsibility all the way up the chain of command that I think in some ways we've forgotten what it's actually supposed to look like. Of course, as Secretary of State, she's responsible. Of course, as president, he is responsible as well. So I think both those people did what I at least think is appropriate and necessary in a democratic society. And I think it by no means abrogates the fact that this was a horrible tragedy that a lot of people had a hand in bringing about.
Okay, so now let's get back to the responsibility of the media. Last week, the House Government Oversight Committee held a hearing on the Benghazi attack. And I guess you'd say the biggest news that came from that, aside from the partisan posturing by the members of the committee, was the testimony from a former security officer from the embassy in Libya. And he said that pleas for better security were rebuffed by those higher up in the State Department. The next morning, the story was page one news. It was the lead story in television, except not at the New York Times. The paper's executive editor and the managing editor were asked about it. They said they made the call because they thought it wasn't really that big a news story. It was more about political grandstanding than anything else. Well, Charles, the Times public editor, called them out on that and quoted from readers who were incensed by that decision. Was it the right decision?
I think it was absolutely the right decision, and I commend the Times for making it. It took courage. The House Oversight Committee, since it was in Democratic control, has been a hyper-politicized body that creates news events for lazy reporters who then go and cover them. This has been going on for, what, a decade now, since Henry Waxman ran the House Oversight Committee for the Democrats. And I do believe the New York Times spilled a lot of ink on a lot of Henry Waxman-fueled conspiracy theories, some of which came true. Right. They're equally spending the same amount of ink inside on the hearings from Libya. They didn't put it on page one, which I think was a really smart call, because the rest of the news media, when it comes to that committee, act like trained SEALs. And I think that using a little bit of discernment about the fact that this was, oh, I don't know, scheduled for the week before the debate in the middle of a presidential election might have had something to do with it.
Okay, given all of that, Lee, if we're going to say that we're going to downplay stories every time that they're politically motivated, what are we going to cover and what are we going to put on page one? Most everything that journalists cover in the political sphere has some political motivation behind it. It's still news, isn't it?
It is still news, and furthermore, it's the good side of politics. This is supposed to be political. That's how the rest of us get involved. Having said all of that, I'm sort of torn between Charles and people who expected it to be there. If the New York Times had put it there, we would be sitting here saying, ah, guilty of PAC journalism, lack of independent thinking. The New York Times didn't put it there. Now everybody else is saying, ah, not guilty of PAC journalism, guilty of too independent a thinking. I don't know, and I suspect that the Times is going to smart from this a little bit and that it's going to influence perhaps some future decisions. I'm not sure that we have yet seen or read or heard the definitive story about Libya. We are certainly a long way from that in understanding what's moving underneath our feet, as Charles said, in the Middle East. There's a lot more coverage that has to happen here. Well,
and I will say that after the criticism, including that from their public editor, the Times ran some great analysis pieces over the weekend about the fallout from the Libya attack. You know, the only problem for me is, well, couldn't they have help themselves, if they even care anymore, to defend against the charges of political bias if they just covered the darn story all the way through with the kind of quality they did on the weekend. But I mean, I think, for example, Charles, and some of those weekend stories, they really did have some nuance to them. They got at whether or not there were witnesses contemporaneously who said that there were protesters there who were motivated by the video. They also said that they reported that there was a lot of difference between the homegrown terrorists, quote unquote, in Libya and Al-Qaeda. I mean, that's the kind of reporting that we need to see more of. So why would they have done both?
Well, I mean, they could have. I just think they saw it as what it was, a pseudo event that was driven entirely for partisan purposes by a committee that about 12 years ago stopped serving the American people in any significant way. And I think that committee deserves to be punished, frankly. They have long since stopped doing their job. They just trot out. It's like the party of opposition intelligence gathering, regardless of who's in the White House. And that's not its purpose. Its purpose is to be an auditor general over the operation of the executive branch.
So does it not matter if this guy who was until recently in charge of security at the embassy, you know, in Tripoli, saying we asked and we asked and we asked for more money, for more security, and we didn't get it? That doesn't matter?
Oh, that's not newsworthy? I think it matters a great deal. And I think it'll matter even more in mid-November. But to do this now, to me, just smacks of political peddling. And dutifully enough, I mean, and the other thing is people are talking about the Times not putting it on page one as if it didn't get coverage. It got covered to death, right? So, I mean, there's plenty of coverage out there. If you want to go, watch the testimony of this guy, you can. It's everywhere. They just decided to not splash it across the front, which I think is editorial leadership.
It's a story. It's not the whole story. It's the worm's eye view, and we all know that the worm has a really good perspective on some things, but it's not everything. And I mean, that's the problem with the Oversight Committee hearing, is we got the worm's eye view and nothing else, including Congress turning around and holding the mirror up to itself and saying, hey, wait a minute, we share some responsibility here too.
Well, I'll let it go after mentioning that it was a little bit unseemly to me that literally almost the day after the New York Times managing editor and executive editor say, it's not a story, it's political, that was almost word for word the line taken by the New York Times editorial page. And that sort of perceived collaboration, I think, is a problem for them. Let's talk about another journalist and a problem that he had that seems to not have at least wrecked his career. Maybe that's a good thing. But you may recall back during the Republican National Convention, longtime D.C. journalist David Chalian, who used to work for PBS, used to work for other networks, happened to be working for Yahoo News, and he was handling their video feeds. Well, he said something into an open mic, and we all know, bias or not, you don't talk into open mics. And what he said was essentially that even though there was a hurricane coming to the Gulf Coast, that the Republicans and Romney didn't care if black people were drowning while they were having their party in Florida. Yahoo News fired him. And everybody said, well, what's going to happen to the guy? It didn't take long to find out. He was not rehired by Yahoo News. He was hired by Politico this past week, and he's going to be managing the video news services for that online political news service. And when asked about it, as they know they would be, Politico said in a statement, Charles, that he screwed up. He admitted he screwed up. He's a great journalist. We should forgive him.
Boy, and it's refreshing to see. I agree. I mean, he's a top flight journalist with a long career. So, I mean, I think context really matters in these things. This isn't some 19-year-old kid who's earned no right to make a major mistake and live through it. And I think there's something about, particularly in journalism circles these days, this idea that an error equals public execution by firing squad instead of coachable moment for veteran journalist who has a whole heck of a lot to bring to the table, and we can get through this and we can work past it. I even thought Yahoo's response was, you know, it was typical. Let's just fire him.
I've had this conversation with two different groups of people in the last week over different instances. The first is with my ethics class when we were talking about some alteration of photographs, both historic and very contemporary, and what they thought the appropriate penalty ought to be. And it's really interesting to talk about what's the distinction between punishment and forgiveness, and at what point do people deserve a second chance, and does what you've done for the previous, 25 years matter in how any particular infraction is evaluated. The second person I had this conversation with is Barney Kalame, who's been visiting here on and off this semester. We gave him an honorary degree at the university a couple of years ago, but Barney's a distinguished journalist from the Wall Street Journal, and ethics is one of the things he really cares about. And he said that he, too, has really been struggling with what is the notion of professional forgiveness. Are there some journalistic sins that are literally unforgivable? And that conversation came up in the context of the country apparently has forgiven Bill Clinton for a very great deal.
That's a deep subject that I think requires maybe another show or two to talk about. But on a much lighter and brighter note, I think, let's wrap up today's program with the stunt that generated 8 million YouTube viewers on Sunday. Austrian Felix Baumgartner's jump out of a balloon over the New Mexico desert and his safe landing 128,000 feet and 4 minutes later. So for those of you who are listening on the radio, you can't see that we're playing back the video, but we see Baumgartner jumping out of this balloon, and we've got a camera that's on his suit showing him tumbling through space, and ultimately we're going to see him pull his chute, and he's going to land successfully in the New Mexico desert, as we mentioned. Well, first of all, maybe while we watch a little bit more of this for our video audience, Lee, this was an amazing event.
It was an amazing event. You sort of want to go, whee, and, you know, all the way down. And it's, I mean, one of the things that's amazing about it is, A, that we can do it, but, B, that we can photograph it in sort of real time.
Well, Charles, many TV outlets around the world carried this feed almost live. There was a bit of a delay. In the U.S., not so much, though. The Discovery Channel had it, but CNN was the only news network to do so, and yet they cut away just before Baumgartner jumped, and they didn't go back to the video until after he landed. I mean, they played it back later. Apparently, they were worried about getting into one of these sort of Fox News car chase suicide moments.
And
was that the right call?
I think it was a very legitimate fear. No one really knew, for scientific fact, what would happen to this guy and whether he would land alive or dead or horribly maimed. And so that was fraught with risk. I mean, and yet, after it was over and he was safely down, it then instantly became a classic. I mean, I don't know how many times I've watched it. I've lost count.
I have to say, though, Lee, I was also watching the live stream from Red Bull. And like 8 million other people, I actually wanted to see the 20-second tape delay of it and watch it myself and decide whether it's time to turn away. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the ratings for that, if you want to call it that, 8 million viewers of that live stream, well, that's as good as a lot of Sunday night TV shows. Is that sustainable, or is that really something you can only do for a few rare events?
I think this is something you can only do for a few rare events, and I think they're going to become – I mean, I think we're going to see this pattern over and over and over again. And for those people who – I think part of the reason it got the viewership that it did is that people just kind of automatically assumed that things were going to be okay. Well, that may be a little bit of a naive assumption, and certainly journalistically it was a very naive assumption. But I don't blame the average person for thinking, hey, you know, this is just another really big carnival ride.
There were British journalists who were following this a lot more closely, I thought, who said that Red Bull actually generated $100 million worth of free media. That's how much they would have to spend on advertising for that campaign. And it really does teach us something about the power of social media for marketing. I guess the other thing, my last sort of notice about it, was that it's really a shame that, you know, some scientists were saying this wasn't that big a deal, it was just a stunt. But I wonder if this is what amounts to discovery when we no longer have a serious space program. We have to get our jollies from watching a guy jump out of a balloon. Well, that's all our time for this week. Thanks for listening and watching. We've placed video clips and several interesting articles about today's topics on our views page. It's under the Talk Shows tab. You can leave a comment there if you like, or you can send it via email to views@kbia.org. Let's acknowledge our technical team before we go, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. Any errors in judgment or rationality are definitely not their fault. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Lee Wilkins, Charles Davis, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.